Okay, we're going on now? If I say, you can only use this plate. Only use this.
It's starting with only. Yes. And this.
Only use.
This. In India, I would say, use this window for fresh air only.
No, that would be the same thing.
Yes.
That would be exactly the same thing. You'd have exactly the same problem.
Yes.
You have the same problem. Okay, so this is part two on September 30th, 2010 of Enculturation. All right, folks, let's go on. So the problem is, right, we were already saying that if you're a universal religion, you have to contact alien cultures. You must, because you're preaching. But the problem is that there's now three kinds of alien cultures. One of them is local to other religions, and two of them are global. And if they're global, then that means they're... If something's global, it's universal. It's everywhere. So this means that these two kinds of global secular culture... For the rest of this presentation, we're just going to say global secular culture, although we mean both of them. And they're quite different from each other. So at this point, because global secular culture is global, even ethnic religions are having to deal with alien cultures. So my point here is that a person can't just say, well, I don't care about alien cultures. So what if there's alien cultures? We're just going to stay in our native culture. We don't have to bother about this presentation. But the point is, A, if you're a universal religion, if you claim to be a universal religion, you're going to contact alien culture. And B, even if you're an ethnic religion, and trying to stay in your own little native culture, you're going to contact alien cultures. Why? Because two of the alien cultures today are?
Global.
They're all over the world. This means if you're going to say, okay, I am going to go to the Himalayas, right? I'm just going to stay in my own native culture. I'm not going to have anything to do with alien cultures. There's televisions in the Himalayas.
There's Belgians
in the Himalayas, yes. Therefore, even Indian children at an ISKCON school in India have to deal with challenges and opportunities often offered by the globalizing secular, modern, and postmodern cultures. Postmodern means relativism. Modern means positivism. Postmodern means relativism. These are not time periods. It's ways of thinking. And we've seen this. We've seen that even in Mayapur, even in Vrindavan, even when devotees are in Mayapur and build a wall around the property, there's still the influence of alien culture, isn't there? Even if you didn't allow any people from alien culture, even if you said, okay, we're only going to allow Bengalis, there would still be the influence of the global positive and post-positive culture, wouldn't there? Because it's now everywhere. And this is a problem happening with the Amish. Burke Rochford, as part of this class, used to show a movie called The Devil's Playground. I don't show it as part of the class, but if you wanted to watch it, you can borrow it from the library here.
I checked it, I don't have it. Someone borrowed it, it was lost. But it was there, because I've seen it.
I know it was there. That's really bad that they've lost it. You should ask them to get it again.
Maybe I should check with all the librarians.
That would be a good idea. What that movie really shows is how the Amish philosophy, that once a person's 16, they have to make up their own mind about whether or not to be an Amish. What's happened now is that their children are contacting a culture that's so alien to theirs that it's really damaging their children. And because they've protected their children totally until the age of 16, their kids can't deal with that alien culture. And it's really harming them. So in any case, there just isn't a religion on the planet today that can say we have no contact with alien cultures. It doesn't exist anymore. You can't shelter yourself. Do we sometimes find that devotees try to do that? That they try to go into some situation where they won't have any contact with alien cultures? Yeah, that's a good example. That's a very good example.
Even contact from our culture in my head.
That's correct. But, you know, he himself is not Indian. but to speak of all the people he's dealing with. So, it's, can he do it? Can he keep out all influence of alien culture? No, he can't do it. It's impossible. So then what we're going to look at is, well, if it's not possible to have no contact with alien culture, what kind of contact do we want to have? So what we're going to look at now, so we're going to look at, and if you read Anthony's article, which I did ask you to read the first part of Anthony's article, then you will find what I'm talking about now much easier to understand. If you didn't read Anthony's article, you're going to be struggling more with this. If you read it, you'll find this, because you already have read most of these things. So Anthony talks about three ways. And any of you who did read it, why don't you tell me what the three ways are? What are the three ways that Anthony says that you can, that a religion can choose to deal with alien cultures?
Teach its children.
First article in this section.
In culture.
Very first article here. Of Francis Vincent Anthony. Did any of you read the first part like I asked you to?
I did.
Talked about three ways that a religion can deal with alien cultures.
Oh, participation.
Well, I suppose one might have to do with what they learn in school, or how would that?
Well, he talks about in relationship to a school, but it's it can be relationship to anybody in the religion. Yeah, it's all over the place here. On page 22, it says, the dialogue between religious faith and societal culture has to take into account these complexities at the macro and the micro level. And okay, what is he listing? Right at the beginning of 2.1, such a rapport could be exclusive, aggressive, inclusive, dialogic, or even relativistic, synchronistic. So those are the three we're going to look at. And we're going to look at first the exclusive, aggressive. So the view in the exclusive, aggressive, I'll have to remember next time to tell people to go a little bit into section 2, is that this is the belief. The belief is the culture of the religion's origin is the only one that can permit authentic expressions of its doctrines and values. Now remember that a native culture by definition is the culture that
it's
its parent culture, and it's the culture that what's special about your native culture?
What?
Lalita. What is special about the religion's native culture?
Is it same as a religion?
It's not the same as a religion. And what's special about a religion's native culture? Why should we even care about this discussion? Who cares?
Same culture.
I don't understand what you mean by the same culture. Same as what?
Is it religion?
Religion, it doesn't make any sense.
It's connected, it's grown with the culture.
So what?
The two.
So what?
What naturally fits for the culture.
So? What's the benefit that a native culture gives to a religion?
The kind of background?
It has meanings already in place.
It probably helps a religion to work.
Yes. How?
And body and soul.
Yes. It's designed to what? Lolita, what does a native culture do? What is the relationship, Lolita, between religion and culture? Lolita.
Culture is like the external, like the way the symbols, like the, and then religion is like the soul. So
okay. So what advantage does a religion have when it can be expressed within its native culture?
It has a body.
It has a what?
It has a body to express itself.
And what's special, you always have to have somebody to express himself. Mm-hmm. What's special about having the native culture?
It expresses itself nicely.
Why?
Because it has many tools to express itself.
What's special about the tools that are in this native culture?
They're
well established. Yeah, because it's like the baby born from a mother has the attributes.
The same attributes?
Functions well in the area where it's taken birth in it. Made for that.
Getting
it's
there.
It's accepted. It's
getting there. Do we have any advantage? Is there any advantage to going to Vrindavan and being a devotee? Not talking spiritually. Culturally. Not talking spiritually. Culturally.
You're supported.
Do we get any advantage in the practice of our Krishna consciousness in Vrindavan or in Delhi?
There is no culture shock over there compared to many other places. If we're dressed as Vaishnavas and we go out,
you can dress as a Vaishnava, you can sit in the airport and chant japa loudly. So what is the advantage of a native culture for a religion? What does a native culture do for religion? It facilitates the practice. It's the most natural expression. It allows for the most natural expression of your religious beliefs. It's like if you have a body that fits your mind. If I want to fly, a human body is alien. I can't express my flying desire very well in a human body. I have to have a demigod body or a bird body.
Okay?
So a culture that's native to a religion is one that allows the religion to best express itself. Why? Because it grew up with the religion. It developed along with the religion. In the case of Vedic culture, it was both developed by God. So it was, in the case of Vedic culture was designed to express Sanatana Dharma. It was designed as a vehicle to express Sanatana Dharma. I have to express my feelings through something. I have to express my beliefs through something. And my native culture, if I had actually Vedic culture, is perfectly designed to express Krishna consciousness. It was designed for that purpose, even more so than European culture is designed to express Christianity. Is it easier to express your Christianity in Europe than it is in India? Definitely. European culture facilitates the expression of Christianity in a way that Indian culture doesn't. Or Chinese culture doesn't. It's harder. Okay, do we all understand now what a native culture is for religion? And an alien culture would be a culture that does what?
Makes it harder.
Makes it harder. Why? Because that alien culture was designed to express
another
religion. was designed for another purpose. Remember, we go back to form follows function. You could say that your native culture is one in which your form fits your function. An alien culture is one in which your form doesn't fit your function. It fits another function. So either it fits the function of another religion, or it fits the function of secularism, which is, you could say, another kind of religion, another set of beliefs. So how are we going to deal with alien cultures? Here we find ourselves in an alien culture. It's like if you woke up in the morning and you're in a fish body, but you still have human consciousness. So we find ourselves in alien culture, dealing with other people from an alien culture. How are we going to deal with it? Can we avoid dealing with alien cultures? It'd be very simple if we just said, we just won't deal with alien cultures. Simple. We can't do that because A, Vedic culture doesn't exist. We can't. Second of all, we can't stop dealing with alien cultures because we're claiming universality. And we also can't avoid dealing with alien cultures because
it's global.
It's everywhere. Okay. Now, three ways we can deal with alien culture. One way is to say the culture of our origin is the only one that can permit an authentic expression of our doctrine and values. We're not saying the native one is the best one. Obviously, the native one is the best one. We're saying if we have an exclusive point of view, we're saying our native culture is the only one. We're saying that expressions of our doctrines and values to other cultures is what? Not just not possible, but not... What's the word here? No, what's the word here?
Progressive.
The expressions... Authentic. If I try to express my doctrines and values to another religion, those expressions will be? Inauthentic.
Well, if you think in this framework.
This is a framework. It's one of three frameworks we're going to look at. This is the first one. This would say, I cannot offer Krishna pizza. I can't. It's inauthentic. I cannot express bhakti authentically through pizza. I cannot express bhakti authentically through a Western business suit. I cannot express bhakti authentically through an electric guitar. I can express it, but it's not really authentic. Because only my native culture is the only one that will allow an authentic expression of my doctrines and values. That's an exclusive position. If you take an exclusive position, you have some benefits. You get very strong support from your culture. You basically try to avoid alien cultures. You have a very aggressive stance toward them. You try to keep them out as much as you possibly can. Whenever you deal with them how? Aggressively. You get very strong support then from your culture. You really try to surround yourself as much as possible with your native culture. You've got a very strong sense of identity. What's the problem? The problem is you may have to create a ghetto. You may have to close yourself off from the alien cultures. You may have to create a little enclave. And if you can't do that, then you become kind of schizophrenic. Because when you're in the alien culture, what can't you do in the alien culture? If you have this worldview, what is... You can't express your
religion.
So this means as soon as I'm dealing with the alien culture, I can't be authentically Krishna conscious anymore. And it also means that when I'm in my native culture, I can't relate to anybody in the alien culture. I have to then have kind of two identities. So if someone has an exclusive aggressive stance, then they almost have to, well, I have to be one person at work and one person at the temple. And people with this stance, if they deal with the alien culture, they can't figure out how to be Krishna conscious in the alien culture because they've already decided that it's impossible to be Krishna conscious. This stance says it's impossible to be Krishna conscious in an alien culture, authentically. You could have some kind of Krishna consciousness, but it wouldn't be very authentic. But then if I'm forced to deal with the alien culture, then I have to become like two people. The other problem with this stance is that if your members are forced to deal with an alien culture, they have to either give up the alien culture or give up their religion. Because we're telling them, you can't do both. Saying you cannot function in the alien culture and be authentically religious. So people, if that's our point of view, then if people have to deal with the alien culture, they'll give up their Krishna consciousness. Or they'll stay within Krishna consciousness and give up everything from the alien culture. Either one of them, they'll have to give up one of them, because we're saying you can't have both. This is clear to everybody. Does everybody understand this?
Mm-hmm.
This is a particular point of view towards alien cultures. This is a point of view that says only my native religion has an authentic expression of my native culture has an authentic expression of my religion, and therefore the only way I can deal with alien cultures is to push them away and keep them out of my life, which gives you a very strong sense of identity, which gives you a strong support for your native culture, but it makes it almost impossible. You can't deal with alien cultures. You can't function in them. You have to function either as a schizophrenic, or you have to, or when you function in them, you have to give up your religion. Yes?
I mean, we see this as something for culture, but sometimes, I mean, it can be seen as something also personal. Like, there are some people that have this kind of problem where they cannot find the just middle between two different worlds, and they force themselves to have to choose really one completely or the other.
I'm not going to categorize. My stance on these three that I'm presenting is that they all have their pros and cons. So there's a strong positive to this. If you can surround yourself with your native culture and try to keep out your alien culture, your native culture is the best way to express your religion. It really is. So if you can do that, you get a lot of strength. The problem is, if you have to contact alien cultures, you really have a problem. So if you can manage to keep the alien cultures out, if you can create a kind of ghetto, it may give you a lot of strength. Okay, now there's a problem, because remember, there's three kinds of alien cultures. So if I have an aggressive stance with an alien culture that's native to another religion, then the people of that other religion are going to feel that I'm attacking them. Now, we feel that when it's directed at us. So if the Christians go to India and convert people to Christianity, and in the process of converting them to Christianity, take away all of their Hindu culture and all their Indian culture, we feel outraged. If they say, okay, now you're becoming a Christian, don't be vegetarian anymore, dress in Christian clothes, we feel very angry. Why are you not only changing their religion, but you're also changing their culture? Okay, next point of view. This is the opposite point of view. This point of view says, doesn't matter. Culture is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. That we can express our religion equally well in any culture. Yes, our religion has a native culture, that's true, but it really doesn't make any difference. Now, again, with anyone who takes a relative point of view, there's nobody who believes this absolutely. In other words, no devotee is going to hold the position that I can be Krishna conscious while eating meat and having abortions. So nobody accepts this 100%. Just like I doubt if there's anyone who's 100% exclusive either. But people who hold this view generally, they'll say the culture doesn't matter. Now, if people say the culture doesn't matter, I can become a pure devotee of Krishna, I can perfectly express Krishna bhakti through any culture. Now, the positive results from that is that they'll be fully able to integrate into any alien culture. They won't have the schizophrenia thing. They won't have this choosing thing. The problems are they could lose their religious identity completely. Because every culture has a religion underneath it. Every culture is an expression of certain beliefs. And if I accept the outward forms of other cultures, I may in turn end up accepting those beliefs as well. And I lose the cultural support of my native culture. I lose the benefits of my native culture, which were designed, especially in our case, which were designed by Krishna to facilitate our religion. Okay. Do you all understand this? Could you explain it to somebody? Okay, so if I just say, okay, I can be Krishna conscious in any, I can be equally, authentically Krishna conscious in any culture. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether I cook chapatis or pizza. It doesn't matter whether I wear a sari or I wear blue jeans. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether I play mridanga or I play a
saxophone.
It just doesn't matter. It's completely, totally irrelevant. That I can authentically express Krishna consciousness through any cultural medium, in any cultural surroundings. I lose the support of my native culture, which was designed to express my religion. It was designed for that purpose. I lose it. And I may lose my religious identity, because if I'm not careful, in adopting other cultural practices, I may take on the mentality that formed those practices. All practices are expressions of some mentality. Now, we have in ISKCON parts of our society and leaders of our society who espouse both of these views I've just gone over. We have leaders who espouse an aggressive, exclusive stance, and we have leaders who espouse a relativistic, synchronistic stance. Okay. Next is the inclusive dialogic. Now, this view is that every culture and society that I meet in time and space is a key to probe into deeper and universal dimensions of our faith and mission. So in other words, there's something in every alien culture that will allow me to express my own faith. This is not saying that other cultures are all bad, and it's not saying that all cultures are good. It's saying that every culture has some good and bad, and there are aspects of every culture that I can use to express my faith. So, on the positive side, this would become an open and profound dialogue. Now, dialogue means two. And the ideal of this is that there'd be a synthesis. That I would get the alien culture to accept some of my religious beliefs, and I, in turn, would accept some of the aspects of the alien culture. We would talk to each other. I would try to infuse some of my beliefs into their culture, and I would take some of their culture and practice it. Now, ideally, this would allow you to keep your core practices while adapting to time, place, and circumstances. If I'm exclusive, I don't have the ability to adapt, and if I'm relativistic, I may lose my core practices. All right, now that sounds wonderful, and you can say, okay, well, why don't we just do that? Well, one thing is, instead of getting the best of both, you might get the worst of both. And you see this in modern India. Modern India has tried to have a dialogue with Western culture, and instead of having the best of India and the best of the West, they seem to have the worst of both in many places. And this is a danger with dialogue. The danger with dialogue is I cannot know what to give up and what to take. And the other thing is, it's hard. It requires a lot of thoughtfulness. The other two positions are easy. One position, I just say, my native culture is the only one that's good for my religion, or every culture is good. I don't really have to think about it. This one, I've really got to think about everything. I've got to think, okay, what part of this culture can I use? Can I use blue jeans? Can I use business suits? Can I use pizza? What's okay, what's not okay? What's going to allow me to have authentic bhakti and what's not? What's going to be dangerous? What's going to be helpful? What can I give the outside culture? How can I present my religious beliefs in a way that will be attractive to people in the outside culture? It requires a lot of thoughtfulness. And I'm putting that as a downside. Why am I putting that as a downside? It's not clear. And there may be a lot of differences of opinion and quarreling over it. It's not clean. It's messy. Yes, Chaitanya.
Sometimes in interfaith dialogue, like a sense that perhaps there's fear of that the faith would be challenged. So this means there fear that this would happen to everyone. And sometimes I felt there was a lot of appreciation from one person belonging to a secret or a religious group, having association of some person from another religious group.
That would be dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when the dialogue was going on, then they were both there. Fear that the other religion wouldn't test my faith.
But we're not so much, in this case, we're not really looking at two religions. We're looking at a religion and the culture of another religion. We're not looking at a religion and a religion. We're looking at a religion and the culture of another religion, which is not the same. It's not the same. In other words, this is asking, can I have Christmas trees and still be Krishna conscious? It's not asking, can I adopt parts of Christianity? It's asking, can I adopt part of European culture? It's not the same. European culture may be native to Christianity, but can I adopt European culture while keeping, having nothing to do with Christianity and just keeping my Krishna consciousness? So this term enculturation, it was a term founded by the Catholic Church that had a policy of wanting to have a dialogic dealing with other cultures. Now, I know you all read for yesterday the synopsis of White's idea of closed, porous, and flexible. So this is very much relating. Now, it's interesting because White was writing not about religions at all. He was writing about organizations. He was writing about, like, charity organizations or welfare organizations, and he talked about them being closed, porous, and flexible. But closed is very, very similar to an exclusive position. Porous is very similar to a relativistic position. The difference between dialogic and flexible, though, is that dialogic is in the middle, and flexible is moving along the line. So that what White is suggesting is flexible is that the organization may choose to move anywhere along this line as the needs present themselves. Whereas dialogic is taking a particular position. And White is saying, the best thing is sometimes close, sometimes open, and move along the line depending on your circumstances, which is not quite the same as dialogic. Dialogic is just staying in the middle.
So that's the best?
I do not know what is the best. My own feeling is that the flexible approach is probably an organization. But that requires even more thoughtfulness than a dialogical.
It requires qualified people to...
Yes. It would require highly qualified people guiding the society. This is easy. This is really easy. Close your doors. Everybody else out there is evil. All other cultures are evil. And this is really easy. All cultures are good. Of course, you can't. Nobody from Buddha is well. I don't think there's anybody all the way. I don't think there's any sane people that are all the way at the end here. Especially all the way at the end here. And that's, I don't believe it. I don't believe there's any sane person who's all the way at the end. Maybe some who are all the way at the end are here. Maybe, but definitely not all the way at the end. Because who would say that, you know, a culture of cannibalism and torture is equal? Nobody would say. I can't imagine. People who would say all cultures are of equal value, I can express my religious belief within any culture, and you'd say, well, could you express your religious belief in Nazi culture? I really can't think of people who would say, oh, yeah, sure. Or could I? Could you express your religious belief in a culture of torture and fear and intimidation? I guess I would say, oh, sure. Unless you have Satanism as your religion. And then if you have Satanism as your religion, you wouldn't be able to express Satanism in a kind, caring culture. So, I mean, there's going to be, unless you don't have any religion at all, unless you're just a nothing. But if you have any kind of beliefs and if you have any kind of values, there's going to be some culture that's so alien, that's so outrageously alien, that you just won't be able to express your beliefs through that culture.
Well, I mean, I would argue what you just said, in that our own governments resort to extreme behaviors in conflict, such as torture and other
yes.
things. This is a sign that, given the circumstances, perhaps we do adopt any kind of the given culture by default. For lack of anything else, like for example, if we were stuck in the, if we have a plane crash in the mountains, then we may end up eating each other.
Well, that's actually a good point. That if you take this philosophy of relativism or postmodernism, that you may end up doing things like torture.
So, in other words, each culture, it can be said that they can be the best way or the only way in a given situation.
Yes. That may be. Thank you. Okay, this is the challenge if you want to be dialogic, what to speak if you want to be flexible. If you're a Western Hare Krishna devotee living in Europe, how do you integrate your religious faith, which has a foreign origin and is closely bound to an alien culture, with one's own indigenous cultural tradition? So, you know, I'm brought up in America. I'm brought up in New York. I have my own cultural tradition. I have my own cultural ways of doing things that are very much part of me in this lifetime. And how do I integrate my religious faith? How do I integrate bhakti that has a foreign origin and is bound to an alien culture? How do I do that? How do I, what amounts of Indian culture do I take on? I mean, if I look at myself, it's very easy for me to take on the externals. It's very easy for me to wear a sari. I pretty much wear a sari every day for the last 37, almost 38 years. I very, very rarely wear anything other than a sari. That's easy. But I'm not able to give people rice when they say no. I can't do it. I don't know how to do it. I'd feel horrible if I did that.
You should practice.
I've tried. I give up.
If you, they ask you to do what?
If people say no to more rice, I won't give them more rice.
Like
I just won't.
In India,
if I go to India and I said, you want more rice, and they say no, I won't give them any more.
You put your hand, they pour on your hand.
Yeah. And I have not been able... You don't have a problem with that? I do.
Well, I mean, if someone wants to put more rice,
no, when you're serving, Jaina Tagore, when you're serving, if you're serving an Indian, and you say, would you like more rice? And that person says no. Do you give them more rice or not? You're the server.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Okay, thank
no.
you. Thank you.
I don't give it.
There you
but
go.
The thing is that the Indians do that, but
yes, the Indians
do.
Well, it's not that they don't have a problem. That's their culture.
Never experienced that.
You probably just didn't think about it. Probably just didn't think about it.
Come on, you're going to go to a really big kitchen.
Have you ever served prasadam? Have you ever served prasadam to an Indian in India?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you ever ask them if they wanted something? I'm sure you did. I'm sure you said, do you want more rice? Or do you just put it on their plate, or do you ask them? Think about it next time. Think about it next time.
Put it on their plate.
Think about whether you put it on their plate or you ask them. And think about how you respond to what they say. I would ask.
Yeah, but it's true that if you say half of this, they are a little bit irritated because they have to adjust because there's a whole line there.
No, I'm asking something different. I'm sitting there and you walk by. Do you ask me or do you just give me? And if I say no, do you give it to me anyway?
I just give you, but if you say no on time, then I don't give you.
Exactly. Whereas an Indian, you could say no on time or not on time, and they're still going to give it to you. So that means that what you're doing is what most of us do. We're bringing parts of our own indigenous culture into our practice of Krishna consciousness. So this is our challenge. I mean, the honest truth is that most of us who are brought up in cultures that are not native to Krishna consciousness, even if you're brought up in the Hare Krishna movement, right, you're not brought up purely in a Vedic culture, are you?
I don't know.
You don't know, right? It's some sort of mishmash.
I need both.
Yeah.
I need someone push me a little bit.
That's right.
Rice.
Well, what you got, what people brought up in the Hare Krishna movement, especially by parents who are from an alien culture, or your mother's Indian, but she's brought up in Belgium or in Netherlands?
She's born in Suriname. I mean, she's not born in India.
She wasn't born in India. Born in Suriname. So that's what's called third culture kids. You know, your parents are from one culture, but they adopt another culture, and you're brought up in that. Right? And it's really, there's very few of us, you know, we're trying to figure this out. How do I kind of get a dialogue? So that's on an individual level, but on a society level, because this is about this kind of society, on a society level, we're also doing that. Now you could say, well, what did Prabhupada want? And you could argue that Prabhupada wanted something exclusive. He wanted us just to have Indian food and Indian dress. You could the language we use. You could argue that he wanted something relativistic. Like here, Prabhupada saying, we don't say that you don't advance in material education. You advance, but at the same time you become Krishna conscious. That's our propaganda. We don't say that you don't. You do not manufacture a motor car, or you do not manufacture these so many machines. We don't say. But we say, all right, you have manufactured this machine, employed in Krishna's service, that is our proposal. We don't say, stop it. That's a very relativistic statement, a very synchronistic statement. Are you all with me here?
Yeah.
So you can get evidence. You can say, well, Prabhupada really had an exclusive point of view. He wanted us just to have our own culture. You could say Prabhupada had a relativistic point of view. And you could say Prabhupada had a dialogic point of view. Prabhupada talked about the lame man and the blind man. Prabhupada established the Bhaktivedanta Institute, which was definitely a dialogic initiative. Had a dialogue between our culture and science. Yes, Alita?
The relativistic, those quotes, I think, doesn't it fit also in dialogue? Because, I mean, he says you use the Krishna service, so it's kind of a mixture. It's like you don't completely accept.
Well, relativistic doesn't mean that you accept the other's belief system. The relativistic point of view is that I can keep my belief system in any culture. The exclusive point of view is I can only keep my belief system in my culture. The dialogic point of view is there's some parts of other cultures where I can keep my belief system, and some parts I can't. Now, as I said, nobody's purely relativistic. Everyone has some aspects of dialogic. At least I don't believe anybody's purely relativistic. You'd have to show me somebody who's 100% relativistic. I don't believe it. But it sounds like what Prabhupada is saying is, whatever you're doing in your culture, obviously with some caveats. I mean, and sometimes I'll preach like that. I'll say, look, you can do anything other than running a liquor shop or a brothel or a slaughterhouse, whatever you do, you can be Krishna conscious in that. That's a relativistic statement. We're saying with a few exceptions, with a very, very few exceptions, there's certain cultural behaviors that it will kill your bhakti. But other than that, you can do anything and you can be Krishna conscious and add Krishna to it. So that's what Prabhupada was saying there. He's saying whatever you know. Whatever you're doing. And Prabhupada was generally against industrial society, wasn't he? And he was saying that industrial society is killing Krishna consciousness. But here he's saying, go ahead and be an industrial society, just add Krishna. Now, if someone has an exclusive point of view, they might say, well, Prabhupada doesn't really mean that, and he's hoping if you chant Hare Krishna, eventually you'll give up your motor car. But, you know, I don't know what he was thinking. Yes?
But that can also be, when someone starts devotion service, then one is not expected to give up
because. Well, you might say that, but I don't know.
any of your life?
I don't know, Dr. Tagore. I really don't know. In other words, to say...
I'm not trying to say that you have to give up the
To say that that's what Srila Prabhupada intended here, to say that he intended this here only for a beginner, and that he expected that after you're a beginner, you're going to give this up. If he says that, fine. What do you mean? Yes. Okay. But yeah, we do. I'm sorry. I was.
Good example.
Yes.
Prabhupada went to the hospital at the very end of his life. That was definitely a compromise. And he
in
advised
London.
His disciples to take help from allopathic medicine whenever required to keep the body and so fit.
Okay.
Krishna, Krishna consciousness. So these are examples that at any stage of life we can, like you say, you know, use the time and circumstance was the phrase that Prabhupada.
Right. And I think that the you know whether it's dialogic or relativistic is how far you're going on the scale. So if I start saying, well, there's a few things I can use, or if I start saying, well, I can use almost anything. Is that clear? I mean, I personally think it would be very difficult to really establish that Prabhupada had a solidly relativistic point. I think it would be hard. You can find a few quotes here and there, you can find a few things here and there that would substantiate it. But my guess is that most of you are going to find it over here. And you're not going to find that much over here. But, you know, there are devotees in ISKCON and even leaders in ISKCON who are preaching a synchronistic way of living. In fact, I don't remember if it was here or the other class, but we talked about Siddhasaru. Siddhasaru took a synchronistic point of view, which is one of the main reasons he split off from ISKCON. Yes?
I remember the previous
point. Oh, good. Okay.
So, I don't think that these two statements could contradict, because what Prabhupada allows is what Prabhupada desires that he would. Because if Prabhupada
okay, but that Jnani Tagore, you're saying the same thing, my dear friend.
No,
you're saying exactly the same thing. You're saying the same thing. You're saying that when you're looking at this statement of Srila Prabhupada here, that when you're looking at this statement of Srila Prabhupada's here, that you're assuming that this is something for a beginner or something that he allowed and didn't want.
No, I didn't say that. He allowed, which means that it's permitted. It's not necessary to stop. If someone is doing that, this means he has permission from Prabhupada. So he doesn't need to stop it.
Okay. But are you
on the other hand,
yeah.
Prabhupada also wanted another.
That's what I'm saying. It's difficult to know. What did Prabhupada want?
For the person, an individual.
He's trying to make the point that Prabhupada would allow people to do things even if he didn't desire it. That
well, that we also know.
No, but that doesn't mean that if you allow them, that they're wrong. They're good for the person.
That may be good for that particular person.
So no need
But as far as what did Prabhupada want for the society of ISKCON? Obviously, each person has to make their own decision. Hey, guys, hello. Obviously, each person has to make their own decision. But as what is what did Srila Prabhupada want for the society? You can have evidence on many levels. You can support either of the three positions. I think the relativistic or synchronistic position would be the most difficult to support. But you could support it. I mean, here Srila Prabhupada is speaking, this is either about dialogic or relativistic, that the devotee finds novel ways and means according to particular time and circumstance, devotional service is dynamic activity.
Couldn't we just say that he was just flexible and depending on
it could be
on the situation, on the time and circumstances, that's how he made his decision.
It very much could be. However, depending on the mentality of the individual is going to interpret Srila Prabhupada probably through the lens of their own mentality. So if a person has an exclusive, aggressive mentality, they're probably going to interpret Srila Prabhupada's quotes that way.
But he probably predicted that.
But
I am not in this presentation taking any stand. I don't want to take a stand. I simply want to present that these are the choices and these are the consequences of the choices. Yes?
But in that way, then it would never be possible to take a stand for something, for one of the choices, because everyone is different, and it's for sure not everyone would agree on the same one. So
that's certainly true.
We can say, oh, Prabhupada was this, Prabhupada was that, but in the same time, it's going to be different for all of us, and we all have a different relationship.
That's true, but still we have then this kind of a society. So I think that most people would agree that each of us as individuals have to make our own choice how we're going to deal with alien cultures. Probably everybody would agree about that. Now, a lot of people would say that some choices are better than others. So people who are really on the relativistic synchronistic side, or people who are strongly on the exclusive aggressive side, they're going to feel that their choice is best. Or people on the dialogic side, they're going to each person tends to feel that their choice is best. And there's often a push by people to try to get ISKCON in a particular way. Which way should ISKCON as a society be? Or should ISKCON be different in different parts of the society? That's another possibility. We talked earlier about the Catholic orders, right? Another possibility is if we have a divisional structure, that certain of our divisions have different, you know, when we talked about our organizational culture, we talked about within ISKCON. Now we're talking about how we relate to cultures out of ISKCON. So it could be that in different places, that some places have more of an exclusive view, some places have more of a relativistic view, and some places have more of a dialogic view, and some places have more of a flexible view. That's entirely possible. Maybe that's the answer. That's what's already starting to happen.
Well, that's how you judge a tree by its fruit. Whatever works.
Whatever works. And, you know, that's my position is, as I said before, are there peaches? You know, if you're going to say I'm a peach tree, do you have peaches? I mean, that's another good example. It's a tree. There's, you all familiar with frankincense? Do you all know what frankincense is?
No.
No? Frankincense is the resin of a pine tree, and you burn it on charcoal. If you've ever seen some temples when the curtains open, there's puffs of smoke.
Oh.
It's frankincense. So frankincense, the best frankincense in the world comes from Oman. It comes from a very particular kind of tree. And these trees can grow literally in rock. They don't need any soil. They can grow directly in rock. They grow in a particular kind of atmosphere. And there's many trees in the world like that. They grow like artichokes. Artichoke plants only grow in some atmospheres. Avocado trees. I mean, there's certain blueberry bushes that need really particular kind of soil in which to grow. And then there are other kinds of trees that can grow almost anywhere. Apples need a certain amount of days of cold, for example. So apples can't grow in a tropical climate. They just can't grow in a tropical climate. So if someone says, okay, I can take my peach tree of bhakti and I can put it in any soil and it'll grow, the proof is that you have peaches. Remember, we're talking about authentic expressions of the religion. So are you able to express your religion authentically? Are you advancing towards Krishna prema? You know, are you preaching? I want to just briefly go through the White's analysis. And he's looking at organizations, not at religion. But he's talking about if you have an exclusive point of view, if you're closed to the outside society, if everything is just internal to the organization, you get a stuck vision, you can't change it to time, place, and circumstance. You're more concerned with your dogma than whether or not you're actually achieving everything. Everybody's euphoric in the beginning and then it gets messy at the end. What does that sound like? What mode of nature? You don't get any support from outside your system. And you measure success by whether people you accept your belief system than by whether or not they actually improve. You're looking more at loyalty than you are at effectiveness. And this little movement of people or ideas in or out of the organization. And members come to depend on the organization for all the professional, social, and sexual needs. This was what ISKCON was definitely like at the beginning. We were a very, very closed organization. And sorry, I hope you can read this. In closed organizations, status and rewards are based on your social relationships instead of by your and who you know instead of what you know and what you can do. Decision-making is corrupted. There's too much time and emotional demands. The organization demands your whole life. doesn't let you have a separate life. There's stress that spills over into your personal lives. Marriages are strained. Members are physically and emotionally depleted. And they look to others for support, including sexual support. There's a breakdown of intimacy barriers. In other words, you start having problems with illicit sex in the organization. And people will terminate marriages, especially if their partner is not involved in the organization. If a marriage occurs when people are in the organization, if either one of them terminates, then the marriage terminates their membership, the marriage may break apart. And the closer people function in the organization, the greater strain on the marriage. And it increases that the exploitation of helpers and clients. This is an enclosed organization. Now, porous organization. This is all the way on the other end. This is an organization that doesn't have any boundary between itself and outside organizations. So unregulated movement of people and ideas across the organization and the rest of society. And then you lose your identity. Who are we now? We've so much mixed with the outside society. We don't know what our values are, who's our membership, what's expected behavior. There's almost no intimacy. So the other one, there's too much intimacy. And here, there's not enough. No sense of mission. Just get assimilated into greater environments. The leaders are invisible or ineffective. The membership doesn't have shared interests. The organization doesn't give you much support. A lot of leader turnovers, a lot of staff discontent. If you try to change something in the organization, you're ignored. And when they want help with the organization, they have to ask people from outside. It's often poor motivation, high turnover of your best and brightest. Flexible organization is which you're controlling your amount of closure and porosity according to the needs and circumstance. So, by the way, if a closed organization was in the mode of passion, what is a porous organization?
Ignorance.
And a flexible organization isn't doing this. It's adjusting to the different circumstances. It has a vision that's alive, and it can be dynamically redefined and refined. And there's steady enthusiasm. Okay, so here's some nice pictures of schools with an exclusive point of view. And here's some nice pictures of situations with a relativistic or dialogic point. Okay, we did not talk about educational culture here. We did not talk about number two. So we defined culture in this context, which is differently than we've defined it before. We talked about native cultures. We talked about Vaishnavism in native culture. We talked about alien cultures. We talked about the three relationships you can have with alien culture. And then we looked at closed, porous, and flexible organizations, which are somewhat different than religions and religions, alien, and native culture, but very similar. Okay? Interesting?
Yeah.
All right. We are approaching our last class. And unless I stay up till 10 o'clock at night, I don't have a PowerPoint for tomorrow. So tomorrow we're going to be looking at, you know what's really nice about having PowerPoints?